Okay, thinking about buying a house. It's definitely one of those huge life moments. Super exciting, maybe a little daunting too.
Oh, for sure. Daunting is a good word.
Start looking online, dreaming a bit, and then you hit the actual process. And suddenly it feels less like a dream and more like, I don't know, navigating a maze blindfolded.
It really can feel that way. The steps, the jargon, the forms, it's a lot. Where do you even begin?
Exactly. Which is why we wanted to do this deep dive. We're looking specifically at source material from Matthew Parsons, who really breaks down the whole home buying journey.
Right. And our mission here is basically to cut through all that complexity.
Yeah, we want to pull out the key steps from his approach and give you a clear, sort of linear roadmap, like what actually needs to happen from, maybe I want to buy, all the way to getting the keys.
Think of this as your shortcut to understanding the nuts and bolts, according to Matthew Parsons. We'll walk through his timeline step by step.
Perfect. So let's jump into this timeline he lays out, starting right at the beginning. Before anything else, Matthew Parsons says there's one big question you got to ask yourself.
And that is, do you need to sell your current home first? Seems obvious, maybe, but the answer really changes the whole equation.
Totally. Selling first adds a whole other layer of timing and complexity. But let's assume for now you don't, or that's handled. What's the very first action step in Matthew Parsons' plan?
Getting pre-qualified. He frames this as absolutely crucial, non-negotiable, really.
And why is that so important right at the start?
Well, it's about avoiding wasted time, mostly, and preventing contracts from falling apart down the line because the financing wasn't actually solid.
He has a good analogy in the source material, right? It's like knowing your grocery budget before you walk into the store.
Exactly. You figure out if you're shopping for filet mignon or hamburger first. Affordability has to come before you start deciding on, granite countertops.
Makes sense. So pre-qualification tells you what specifically?
Two key things. One, your actual budget, what you can realistically afford. And two, the type of loan you'll likely get.
Okay. And the source touches on a few different loan types people might run into. There's the standard conventional loan, right? From a bank or credit union.
Yep, that's the most common. Then you've got government-backed options, like FHA loans.
Those are often flagged as good for first-time buyers. Maybe lower down payments.
Sometimes, yeah. Potentially better rates or lower down payments. But, and this is a point Matthew Parsons stresses, FHA loans come with extra hurdles, more inspections, stricter property requirements.
Ah, because the government's backing it.
Right. And that can actually limit your options because not every seller or every house is ready for that level of scrutiny.
Okay. What about VA loans?
Similar situation for veterans. A fantastic benefit, absolutely, but VA loans also have their own specific requirements. Matthew Parsons notes this can sometimes make sellers hesitate, especially, he mentions, in his market for homes under about $300. He calls it a shame, but it's a reality.
Good to know. He also lists USDA for rural areas.
Yeah, another government-backed one for eligible rural properties. And then, of course, there's cash.
Which puts you in a strong position, he says.
Very strong. You often get to skip the appraisal, at least initially, which speeds things up.
Okay, so to recap those loan types mentioned, conventional, FHA, VA, USDA, and cash. Getting pre-qualified clarifies which path you're likely on. Step one.
Step one sets the foundation.
Got it. Finances are getting clear. What's step two in a Matthew Parsons roadmap?
The strategy session. This is where you actually sit down ideally with your agent and get really specific about what you're looking for.
And the goal here, as he puts it, is to make the search smart and simple, right? Avoid looking at tons of unsuitable houses.
Precisely. It's about nailing down the non-negotiables, the must-haves.
Yeah.
He uses an example like needing four bedrooms because you have eight kids, or maybe you absolutely need a fenced yard for the dog.
Or at least know you can add one.
Right. Or knowing you can add one, it's not just the house features either. It's about what days you're actually free to look at places, which specific neighborhoods or areas you're targeting.
So really drilling down.
Yeah. And he even mentions sending out like a quick 10, 15-minute survey beforehand to gather some of this info, make the session even more productive.
He shares a story about that, doesn't he? A client finding it much simpler than their friend's experiences.
He does. It highlights how having that structure up front can make the whole thing feel less chaotic. It sets expectations clearly.
Okay, so finance is clear, search criteria defined. Around this time, Massey Parsons says there's some important initial paperwork to handle.
Yes. Usually digital these days, he mentions Dotloop as an example platform, but you should still get PDF copies to review carefully. And everyone signing needs their own unique email address. That's important for the systems.
What are the key documents here? He flags one as the most important.
That would be the exclusive buyer's representation agreement. This is the document that officially makes you the agent's client. It formalizes the relationship.
And this is where commission comes up.
It is. The source mentions 3% of the purchase price as a common figure. Matthew Parsons explains the recent shift in the industry, how it used to be standard for the seller to cover the buyer's agent fee through their listing agent.
But now technically it's the buyer's responsibility.
Technically, yes. But he clarifies that in practice, it's very often handled through seller concessions. So you might offer, say, $300,000 for the house, but ask the seller to credit you back $9,000 at closing specifically to pay your agent.
Ah, so it's negotiated as part of the deal.
Exactly. And he's quick to add that the commission percentage itself is negotiable. Maybe it's 2.5%, maybe 2%. His stated priority is getting you the house, and they'll work out how the commission gets paid negotiating with the seller. Maybe you contribute. Maybe he even reduces his commission slightly.
So flexibility there. What else does that agreement cover?
It also locks in things like the price range you're looking in, the geographic area, and outlines the agent's specific duties to you.
Okay. What's next in the paperwork stack? He mentions a warning he calls huge.
Yeah, the wire fraud warning. This is critical.
Because people can lose a lot of money.
A lot.
He shares a really sobering story in the source about a family member losing over $100,000 because they trusted wiring instructions they got in an email. Just clicked and sent.
Wow.
Yeah. The takeaway is crystal clear. If you are wiring money, you absolutely must call the title company directly using a phone number you know is correct to verify those instructions before you send anything. Do not trust email alone for this.
That story definitely makes you pay attention. Okay, what else?
There's an affiliated business contract basically disclosing if the agent's company owns like a mortgage or title company. He notes he generally doesn't use those affiliates.
And then there's one he calls the I'm an idiot form.
Yeah, that's his term for the basic disclaimer.
Which says what?
It just clarifies that your agent is a real estate expert, but they are not your tax advisor, your home inspector, your structural engineer, or your lawyer. You can't rely on, you know, an off-the-cuff comment they make about property lines or tax implications as professional advice in those areas.
Got it. Sets the boundaries. Okay, paperwork's done, strategy's set. Now we actually find the house. Matthew Parsons is big on using the MLS, the multiple listing service. Why that over, say, Zillow?
Two main reasons he gives. First, it's the most robust tool for searching. The filters are much more detailed, letting you narrow things down based on all those criteria from your strategy session.
More powerful search.
Way more powerful. Second, it's the most up-to-date. Realtors list properties on the MLS first, so you get notified instantly when something matching your needs hits the market, gives you a head start.
And the MLS has features to help manage the search.
Yeah, like starring properties you like, saving them, and importantly, he mentions the ability to hide listings you've already seen or decided against.
Oh, that sounds useful. Keep the list clean.
Exactly. Stops you from getting overwhelmed seeing the same unsuitable houses again and again. Yeah. Plus, your agent can see what you star and hide, which helps them understand your preferences without you having to constantly send links back and forth.
Smart. And you can rank the ones you save.
Yep, like giving them 3 stars or 2 stars, helping you prioritize which ones you want to see first.
Okay, so you're using the MLS, getting alerts, you start a few promising places. Now it's time to actually go look at homes.
Right. And how this starts might vary. Matthew Parsons mentions that if you're maybe new to the area or just starting out, you might do a longer tour day, see several places across different neighborhoods just to get your bearings.
Get a feel for things.
Exactly. The goal of those first viewings isn't always finding the one right away. It's more about calibrating your expectations. Seeing what's out there helps you recognize what you really want and, importantly, what you don't want.
So when the right one does pop up, you know it.
You know it and you appreciate why it's right and what its value is. But he also warns against looking at too many homes.
Why is that? Isn't seeing more better?
Not necessarily. He says it's mostly a waste of time yours, the agents, the sellers, and psychologically. Yeah. He brings up this idea of paralysis by analysis.
Too many choices make it harder to choose.
Precisely. He even references an old movie, Logan's Run, about perceived choice. Sometimes having fewer, more targeted options, maybe looking seriously at, say, 15 homes that really fit your criteria, actually makes you feel more confident and comfortable when you do make a decision.
Interesting. So limit the noise.
Yeah. And After those initial exploratory viewings, the process usually gets more focused. You might only look at one or two specific new listings as they come up, often hitting the market Thursday through Saturday.
Okay, so you've done the viewings, you've refined your search, and bam, you found it, the house. What's the immediate next step, according to Matthew Parsons?
Making an offer. But first, a crucial little detail. Get a specific pre-approval letter from your lender for the offer price on that specific property.
Not just your max approval amount.
Right. Don't show the seller your entire hand, basically. Don't reveal you could potentially pay more. It keeps your negotiating position stronger.
Smart. Okay. Then comes the offer paperwork itself. What's involved there?
The main document is the purchase and sale agreement, or PSA. That's the core contract, your actual offer.
Okay.
Then there's a confirmation of agency form. This just clearly states who represents the seller and who represents you. Pretty straightforward.
And the seller's disclosure. We mentioned that briefly.
Yep. Where the seller has to list any known problems with the house, leaky roof, old furnace, whatever they're aware of.
Are there exceptions where they don't have to provide that?
Yeah, the source notes a few common ones, like if the owner is deceased and never lived there, or if it's been a rental property for a long time, like 3+ years, and the owner hasn't lived in it. Also, house flips and brand new construction typically don't require the standard disclosure.
Gotcha. What about lead paint?
Right, the lead-based paint disclosure. This is required for any house built before 1978. The seller has to disclose if they know there's lead paint. But honestly, often they don't know because they haven't tested for it.
So it might just say, seller has no knowledge.
Pretty much. And finally, if you're using an FHA or VA loan, there will be a specific FHOV addendum attached. This just lets the seller know upfront about that loan type and any associated conditions.
Okay, quite a stack of papers for the offer. You submit it. Then what?
Then you wait for the seller's response. That's step 8. Offer response and negotiation. Usually your offer includes a deadline for them to respond. Common courtesy is about 24 hours, but that can vary depending on the situation.
And the seller can do what?
3 basic things. Accept your offer as is. Yay.
The dream.
Haha, yeah. Or they can reject it outright. Or, very commonly, they can counter your offer.
And the counter can be about anything, not just price.
Anything in the contract, yep. Closing date, repairs, included appliances, though price is definitely the most frequent negotiation point. Matthew Parsons mentions he tries to anticipate these by asking the listing agent about the seller's preferences beforehand, like their ideal closing timeline.
What if there are multiple offers? That sounds stressful.
It can be. Your agent should tell you if that's the case. But Matthew Parsons advises not to be automatically scared off. You don't know if it's one other offer or 10. If you love the house and it fits your comfortable budget, put your best foot forward. You can always withdraw later if something better comes along before you're fully bound.
Okay, so let's say they accept or you agree on a counteroffer. Everyone signs electronically. Step 9 is going under contract.
Exactly. Your agent does that final binding signature. And that moment right there becomes day 0 for all the timelines spelled out in the contract.
And he uses that analogy again. You're engaged.
Right. Committed, moving forward, but not legally finalized yet. You're not married until closing day.
This engagement period kicks off a really important phase, right? Step 10, the inspection period.
Absolutely critical. This is usually your first major deadline after going under contract.
How long do you typically have?
Generally 7 to 10 days. If day 10 falls on a Saturday, your deadline rolls over to Monday.
Okay, so maybe a bit more calendar time than it sounds, but still focused.
Yeah.
What's your job during this period?
Your responsibility is to get inspections done, hire inspectors, schedule them, get their reports back. And based on those findings, you need to submit a repair proposal back to the seller before that deadline hits.
What kind of inspections are we talking about?
The main one is the general home inspection. Matthew Parsons estimates this around $500, $700 in the source. He suggests inspectors, but says you can use your own.
Okay. What else?
A termite inspection. Often required by the lender anyway. Sometimes the home inspector includes it, sometimes it's separate.
And he specifically recommends radon testing.
Especially in his area, Knoxville, yes. He recommends a radon inspection. Radon is that invisible, odorless gas that can cause lung cancer. He even notes that heavy rain can sometimes push more gas up from the ground, potentially leading to higher readings.
And if it is high, what's the fix?
It's called radon mitigation. Basically, they install a ventilation system to pull the gas out from under the foundation and vent it outside. He estimated the cost around $2,500 when the source material was put together.
During this inspection period, you might also get quotes for specific issues found, right? Like from a plumber or an electrician.
Definitely. If the home inspector flags a potential major issue with the roof or the HVAC, you might want to get a specialist out there during your inspection window to give you a proper estimate for repairs. It's all about gathering information.
Okay, while all this inspection stuff is happening, what's going on with the loan?
Right, that's step 11, starting your loan process officially. You usually have about 3 days after going under contract to formally apply with your chosen lender, get that ball rolling.
Can you still shop around for lenders at this point?
Matthew Parsons says you can, but be really careful to compare offers apples to apples. Look closely at fees and rates. Sometimes a lender might offer a big credit up front, but make it back with higher fees hidden elsewhere. Due diligence is key.
Got it. Then there's step 12, earnest money. What exactly is that?
Think of it as a good faith deposit. It's like a down payment on the contract itself, showing the seller you're serious and intend to buy the house. It's separate from your main loan down payment.
And who holds this money?
Your agent, or rather their brokerage, usually holds it in an escrow account until closing. Then it gets applied towards your purchase price or closing costs.
What if the deal falls through during inspections? Do you get the earnest money back?
Typically, yes. If you back out for a valid reason allowed by the contract, like uncovering major structural issues during inspection that you and the seller can't agree on how to resolve, Matthew Parsons stresses this point.
But you don't get the money back that you paid for the inspections themselves.
Correct. He makes that distinction very clear. Paying the inspector is paying for a service they performed, like paying someone to mow your lawn. That money's spent. The earnest money is about your commitment to the purchase itself.
How much is typical for earnest money?
He mentions $1,000 is common, but it can definitely be higher for more expensive homes or in really competitive situations to show you're a strong, committed buyer.
Okay, inspections are done, reports are in. If issues were found, we move to step 13, the resolution period.
Right. This is the negotiation phase for repairs. Matthew Parsons recommends keeping this period short, maybe 2 or 3 days max. You submit your repair proposal based on the inspection findings.
And what kind of repairs should you focus on? Cosmetic stuff?
Generally, no. He advises focusing on health, safety, and structural issues. Things like electrical problems, plumbing leaks, roof issues, HVAC problems. Not things like, I don't like the paint color, or I want different cabinet handles.
Makes sense. What are the options for resolving these issues?
Several possibilities. The seller could agree to fix some or all of the items before closing. Or you might renegotiate the purchase price down. Or the seller could offer you a credit towards your closing costs.
Or they could buy down discount points. You mentioned that earlier. Why is that a huge benefit in his view?
Right. So discount points are basically prepaid interest. You pay the lender at closing to get a lower interest rate on your loan for the entire loan term, if the seller pays those points for you.
It lowers your monthly payment for potentially 30 years.
Exactly. While a closing cost credit is nice cash in your pocket right now, having the seller buy down your interest rate can save you significantly more money over the long haul. Thousands, potentially tens of thousands, in interest saved. It's a really valuable negotiating tool.
Good to understand that difference.
Yeah.
So the goal is to find a solution everyone agrees on.
Yeah. And sellers are often motivated to resolve legitimate safety or structural issues because they know those same problems will likely just come up again with the next buyer if your deal falls through.
Okay. Once you get through the inspection and resolution, which Matthew Parsons notes is often the first couple of weeks under contract, things usually calm down a bit. Step 14, the waiting period.
Yep. The initial flurry of activity slows down. You're not constantly sending documents back and forth to the lender quite as much during this middle phase. Your lender is working behind the scenes on underwriting.
But there's still a big hurdle coming up, right? Step 15, the appraisal.
This is often the nail biter, especially for financed buyers. Cash buyers might skip it, but if you have a loan, the bank needs this.
Why does the bank care so much?
Because they're lending you hundreds of thousands of dollars, potentially. The appraisal is their independent assessment to make sure the house is actually worth the price you've agreed to pay. They need to protect your investment. They don't want to lend more than the property's value.
How does the appraisal actually happen? Does someone come out?
It varies. Could be an in-person visit from an appraiser. Could be a drive-by appraisal. Sometimes, depending on the loan and property, it might even be a desktop appraisal using online data. Matthew Parsons does note that FHA and VA loans typically require an in-person appraisal.
And those FHAV appraisers might flag things even if you didn't ask for them in your repair proposal.
Yes, that's a key point he makes. They have their own checklists. They might require things like peeling paint to be scraped and repainted, or a broken window fixed, or a loose handrail secured, even if those weren't things you negotiated with the seller. The loan won't close until those specific items are addressed.
Okay. What happens if the appraisal comes in low? Less than the purchase price.
That triggers another negotiation period, according to Matthew Parsons. Not fun, but necessary.
What are the options then?
Basically, three choices. One, you ask the seller to lower the purchase price to match the appraised value. Two, you, the buyer, come up with extra cash out of pocket to cover the difference between the appraised value and the contract price. Or three, if neither of those works, everyone can walk away from the deal, and you should get your earnest money back because the financing contingency wouldn't be met.
Feels like a critical moment where a deal could fall apart.
It definitely can be. But on the bright side, if the appraisal comes in higher than your purchase price, great. You have instant equity in your new home.
Okay, assuming the appraisal goes okay, we're getting close.
Yeah.
Step 16, final walkthroughs.
Yep, usually done a day or two before closing. The main purpose is to double check that any repairs the seller agreed to make during the resolution period have actually been completed and completed properly.
And just to make sure the house is still in the same general condition, right? No
sure.
New damage.
Exactly. Make sure no one knocked a hole in the wall moving out, or that the appliances that were supposed to stay are still there. Your agent might even do a quick final check with you on the actual day of closing, too.
And there's paperwork for this?
Two forms, usually. The buyer's final inspection form, saying you've checked and things look okay. And the disclosure update form, where the seller confirms nothing major has changed with the property's conditions since their initial disclosure.
All right. All checks passed. Now for the grand finale. Step 17. Closing.
This is it. The I do moment, as Matthew Parsons puts it, this happens at the title company where the legal ownership officially transfers.
How is it usually scheduled? Everyone together?
It varies. Sometimes buyers and sellers are at the same table. Sometimes they sign at different times or even different locations. Sellers might pre-sign. Matthew Parsons also mentions mail-away closings are possible if you absolutely can't be there in person, but that takes extra planning, involves a notary, and requires a wet signature, no e-signing the final deed documents.
How long should you expect closing to take?
If you're getting a loan, he suggests planning for about 45 minutes to an hour. Lots of papers to sign, deed documents, loan documents. Your hand will probably cramp.
You should know the final cost beforehand, right? From the closing disclosure.
Yes, absolutely. You're legally required to receive the closing disclosure, or CD, at least 3 business days before closing. Review it carefully. It breaks down every single cost and tells you the exact amount of money you need to bring.
And bringing that money, cashier's check, wire transfer, and that warning again.
Both are usually options. You can typically bring a cashier's check or wire the funds beforehand. But if you wire and Matthew Parsons hammers this home again, call the title company directly using a trusted number to verify their wiring instructions before you initiate the transfer. Remember that $100K plus loss story. Don't let it be you.
Seriously. What else should you bring to closing?
Your ID. Probably a couple forms of it, like driver's license and passport, and maybe a penny light because you'll be doing a lot of signing.
Okay, paper signed, money transferred. Step 18. You get the keys.
That's the moment. The house is officially yours. Congratulations.
But it's not quite over. Step 19, post-closing stuff, like utilities.
Right, practicalities. Matthew Parsons mentions his process includes sending utility company contact info about a week before closing, so you can call them and arrange to have service switched into your name effective on the closing date. You might need to show them proof of ownership, like part of your closing paperwork.
And he also has resources for other moving tasks.
Yeah, he mentions a page on his website, MatthewParsonsHomes.com, moving, with checklists and tips for things like changing your address with the post office, updating your driver's license, etc.
Okay. Now there's one final crucial warning Matthew Parsons includes. Something not to do while you're under contract. Step 20.
This is huge. While you are under contract, before closing, do not make any large purchases, especially on credit.
Like, don't go buy all new furniture for the house.
Exactly. Don't buy furniture on credit. Don't finance a new car. Don't even open a new store credit card. Nothing that significantly changes your debt load or credit profile.
Why is that so critical right at the end?
Because your lender will almost certainly do a final credit check and employment verification right before closing. If they see new debt or a big change in your finances, it can throw a major wrench into the final loan approval. It could delay closing, change your loan terms, or even cause the loan to be denied entirely. Matthew Parsons says it can ruin the whole process. Just wait until after you close.
Wow. Okay, that is a vital piece of advice.
Yeah.
So we've really walked through the entire journey following Matthew Parsons' linear timeline. From that initial thought, getting pre-qualified.
Through the strategy session, the search, using the MLS, making the offer, navigating all that paperwork.
The critical inspection and resolution periods, the appraisal hurdle, final walkthroughs, and finally, closing and getting those keys.
We've hit on his key takeaways. The importance of that upfront financial work, defining your needs, understanding the contracts like the buyer's rep agreement and commission, using the right tools, managing inspections and negotiations, and that crucial final warning about finances.
It really shows it's not just a checklist. Each step has decisions, potential issues, and things you, as the buyer, need to be aware of to have that smart, simple process Matthew Parsons talks about. Understanding the why seems really key.
It demystifies it a lot, I think. Takes away some of the fear and replaces it with a plan based on his experience outlined in the source.
Definitely. So thinking about this whole complex journey, all the financial bits, the house condition bits, the legal stuff, just the logistics. If someone's listening and just starting to think about this, what do you think is the single most important piece of proactive research they could do before they even pick up the phone to call an agent, just to feel more prepared?
That's a great question to ponder. What piece of homework would give you the most confidence heading into this?
Something for you all to think about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Matthew Parsons' Guide to Buying a Home.